Bros and Ghouls, it's going to be a dark ride. We'll keep the lights on for now. No talking, because it's story time at the Wicked Library.
And welcome back, everyone, to the Wicked Library. And this is an unnumbered best of. This is the best of the holiday specials. Should I use my stinger here? I haven't used my stinger in quite some time. Give me the stinger! And holy cow, I love my stinger. We'll just let it ride there. You all know, deep in my heart, how much I love my stinger and how much my stinger loves me. But what you didn't know is my stinger loves you too. Oh, yes. Yes, it does. All right, let's leave my stinger alone for now before we all go blind. Anyway, welcome back to the Wicked Library. This is the last of the best of episodes. This is the best of the holiday specials. And during the first season, I wanted to do holiday specials. Damn it, my show. I wanted to do holiday specials. So we did the Halloween episode, which was done entirely by the librarian, who has not made an appearance at all during season two, and I'm sure he's mighty pissed about that. You know, I'm sorry about that, the librarian. You only hear him in the intro. You know, he came in and banged that thing out. And then there was the Chris Massacre episode, and the librarian did show up on one piece for that. Now, the cool thing about the Halloween episode is that it was an unusual one in that it was not by an author that is currently alive. And there were three stories in all, and that was a really long episode, but it was a really fun episode for me because I got to do a few classics. And I will be playing two of them on this episode. The Christmas episode, however, was a little bit different. I had some of my pals, who are excellent inksmiths, write me some stuff. Some stuff was specifically for the Christmas episode. And some had already been written, but great stuff all around. And I've decided, considering that it is my show, and I do have a thing or three to promote, I figured I'd throw in one of mine as well. So, anyway, before we get any further, let me pay some bills here. Why don't you listen to this?
Author C. Brian Brown says, "Delightfully gory and laugh-out-loud funny, Demons, Dolls, and Milkshakes will keep you reading and have you reaching for a cigarette when you're done." Lydia Peaver, author of Nightface, says, "Demons, Dolls, and Milkshakes goes from gray to black, page by page, then full dark, and only then begins the bleed. Hard to believe it is a horror author's debut work. Read Demons, Dolls, and Milkshakes, the debut novel by Nelson W. Piles. Only available from Postmortem Press, coming this September."
For more information, visit www.postmortem-press.com. Publishing outside the lines. And you can get that book right bloody now. Demons, Dolls, and Milkshakes is available on Amazon.com. You can go direct to postmortem-press.com. Click on the fantastic cover that was done by our very own Maddie Von Stark. Real quick story, I made the Stitch doll, as you may or may not know, and I FedExed it over to Maddie in the wilds of Cheese Country. And within 15 minutes of getting Stitch in physical form, she went to work, and 15 minutes later, I had the cover of the book. Knocks it out of the park every damn week. Maddie, you are awesome, and we'll be talking about Maddie a little bit later, but let's get rocking on this episode. Now, this is the best of the holiday specials. We did two specials. The first one was Halloween, and the second was Christmas-themed, and it was called the Chris Massacre episode. That was our season finale for season one. So I didn't want to play them both back-to-back because that is entirely too much of a time investment. this show ain't that good. It's good. Don't get me wrong. It's damn good. But I wanted to pick the best ones out of there, and even threw in one of my favorite stories that I've done. But let's start off with the Halloween-y episodes. And this one, of course, you may all be vaguely familiar with, by the late, great Edgar Allan Poe. This one barely needs an introduction, but I'm going to give you one anyway. This is The Raven.
The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe. Once, upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered, weak and weary, over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping, as if someone gently rapping, rapping at my chamber door. "'Tis some visitor," I muttered, "tapping at my chamber door. Only this, and nothing more." Ah, distinctly I remember it was in the bleak December, and each separate dying ember wrought its ghost upon the floor. Eagerly I wished the morrow. Vainly I had sought to borrow from my book's surcease of sorrow. Sorrow for the lost Lenore, for the rare, radiant maiden, whom the angels name Lenore, nameless here forevermore. And the silken, sad, uncertain rustling of each purple curtain thrilled me, filled me with fantastic terrors never felt before, so that now, to still the beating of my heart, I stood repeating, "'Tis some visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door, some late visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door. This it is, and nothing more." Presently my soul grew stronger, hesitating then no longer. "Sir," said I, "or madam, truly your forgiveness I implore, but the fact is I was napping, and so gently you came rapping, and so faintly you came tapping, tapping at my chamber door, that I scarce was sure I heard you. Here I open wide the door. Darkness there, and nothing more." Deep into that darkness peering, long I stood there wondering, fearing, doubting, dreaming dreams no mortal ever dared dream before. But the silence was unbroken, and the stillness gave no token, and the only word there spoken was the whispered word, "Lenore?" This I whispered, and an echo murmured back the word, "Lenore!" Merely this, and nothing more. Back into the chamber turning, all my soul within me burning, soon again I heard a tapping somewhat louder than before. "Surely," said I, "surely that is something at my window lattice. Let me see, then, what thereat is, and this mystery explore. Let my heart be still a moment, and this mystery explore. 'Tis the wind, and nothing more." Open here I flung the shutter, when, with many a flirt and flutter, in there stepped a stately raven of the saintly days of yore. Not the least obeisance made he, not a minute stopped or stayed he, but with mine of lord or lady perched above my chamber door, perched upon a bust of Pallas just above my chamber door, perched and sat, and nothing more. Then this ebony bird beguiling my sad fancy into smiling, by the grave and stern decorum of the countenance it wore. "Though thy crest be shorn and shaven, thou," I said, "art sure no craven, ghastly grim and ancient raven wandering from nightly shore. Tell me what thy lordly name is on the night's Plutonian shore." Quoth the raven, "Nevermore." Much I marveled this ungainly fowl to hear discourse so plainly, though its answer little meaning, little relevancy bore. For we cannot help agreeing that no living human being ever yet was blessed with seeing bird above his chamber door, bird or beast above the sculptured bust above his chamber door, with such a name as Nevermore. But the raven, sitting lonely on the placid bust, spoke only that one word, as if his soul in that one word he did outpour. Nothing further then he uttered, not a feather then he fluttered, till I scarcely more than muttered, "Other friends have flown before. On the morrow he will leave me, as my hopes have flown before." Then the bird said, "Nevermore." Startled at the stillness broken by reply so aptly spoken, "Doubtless," said I, "what it utters is only stock in store, caught from some unhappy master, whom unmerciful disaster followed fast, and followed faster till his songs one burden bore, till the dirges of his hope that melancholy burden bore, of never, nevermore." But the raven, still beguiling all my fancy into smiling, straight I wheeled a cushioned seat in front of bird and bust and door. Then upon the velvet sinking I betook myself to linking fancy unto fancy, thinking what this ominous bird of yore, what this grim, ungainly, ghastly, gaunt, and ominous bird of yore meant in croaking nevermore. This I sat, engaging in guessing, but no syllable expressing, to the fowl whose fiery eyes now burned into my bosom's core. This and more I sat divining, with my head at ease reclining on the cushion's velvet lining that the lamplight gloated o'er, but whose velvet violet lining with the lamplight gloating over, she shall press, oh, nevermore. Then methought the air grew denser, perfumed from an unseen censer, swung by seraphim, whose footfalls tinkled on the tufted floor. "Wretch," I cried, "thy God hath lent thee, by these angels he hath sent thee, respite, respite and nepenthe from thy memories of Lenore. Quaff, oh quaff this kind nepenthe, and forget the lost Lenore." Quoth the raven, "Nevermore." "Prophet," said I, "thing of evil, prophet still, if bird or devil, whether tempter sent, or whether tempest tossed thee here ashore, desolate yet all undaunted, on this desert land enchanted, on this home by horror haunted, tell me truly, I implore, is there balm in Gilead? Tell me, I implore." Quoth the raven, "Nevermore." "Be that word our sign in parting, bird or fiend," I shrieked upstarting, "get thee back into the tempest and the night's Plutonian shore. Leave no black plume as a token of that lie thy soul hath spoken. Leave my loneliness unbroken. Quit the bust above my door. Take thy beak from out my heart, and take thy form from my door." Quoth the raven, "Nevermore." And the raven, never flitting, still is sitting, on the pallid bust of Pallas just above my chamber door. And his eyes have all the seeming of a demon's, is dreaming. And the lamplight over him streaming throws his shadow on the floor. And my soul from out that shadow that lies floating on the door shall be lifted nevermore.
And that was Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven. You really don't get much more classic than that. We're going to leave Halloween momentarily, and we're going to hop, skip, and jump to a Christmas poem. Now, this poem was written specifically for the Wicked Library, and it's a cool one, and it is read by the librarian. Won't you please pretend it's cold and listen to one of my two favorite Canadians, Mandy DeGates. All I Want for Christmas Is You.
All I Want for Christmas Is You by Mandy DeGate. Unopened Christmas cards lay forgotten on the shelf. So different is this holiday since I'm all by myself. Santa and his sleigh towed by 9 horned deer. Garland, balls and tinsel all choke me with cheer. Remember when we were happy, times so long ago? I think of how you kissed me beneath the mistletoe. Once upon a time, you said I'd make the perfect wife. Together, you promised, for the rest of my life. I smile as I think back to the moments we had. My one little motion brought good out of bad. Never again will we argue or fight. 'Tis the season to begin what's finally right. Your dark red blood has stained my floor. I slit your throat as you spat the word whore. Your dead, rigid body lies wrapped under the tree. The perfect boyfriend, from now on, you'll be.
Boy, Chris for sure is different candidate. Sorry, Mandy. Couldn't help it. Anyway, that was Mandy DeGate, one of my two favorite Canadians. The other one being, of course, I'm going to have to put Echo on this one because I do it very frequently and I do it unconsciously, I think, at this point. But this one I'm doing totally intentionally. Ready? Lydia Peaver. There. I've dropped her name. I might instill that echo every time I mention her name. But, oh, it's late. Anyway, that was Mandy DeGate. Mandy wrote that especially for the show, and she was pretty jazzed that the librarian did the reading on that one. And so was I. The librarian, he makes everybody happy, damn it. If you want to check out more of Mandy's work, you can find her online at mandydegate.com. Check her out. And on to our next piece. This is another hunk of Christmas. This is best-selling author Jessica McHugh. And she sent this. I'd asked her about, I guess, a week or two before recording the episode for the Christmas special if she had anything Christmas themed, and she sent me two things. One was a short story based in the world of her novel Rabbits in the Garden. And if you haven't gotten Rabbits in the Garden, in spite of me telling you to go get Rabbits in the Garden, well, you have only yourself to blame, because the book is awesome as hell. And she sent me a Christmas themed story based on the characters from that. And she sent me the poem, which I'm about to play for you now. And it's funny. It's damn funny. Good stuff from the always clever Jessica McHugh. Wrap your ears around this. Give it a listen.
"'Twas the Night Before Something" by Jessica McHugh. "'Twas the night before Christmas when I finished the rum and wrapped up my drunken pa-rum-pa-pum-pum. The stockings were hung, haphazardly so, too close to the fire, starting to glow. The children were still up, waiting for morn, reading their young adult vampire porn. I passed out on the landing, the stairs were too steep. I'd had too much liquor to do more than sleep. A clamor outside made me wake with a yawn, and my dream about Neil Patrick Harris was gone. I grumbled and groaned and tripped over the trash of pre-Christmas presents I'd trade in for cash. A shadow was cast on the lawn badly kept. Plastered and puzzled outside, I slept. When what to my hammered red eyes should appear? A decorative deer missing both of its ears. With a little old redneck behind the deer crouched, I remembered I'd earlier punched the guy out. More rapid than gumbo, lost hours arrived, reminding that rum wasn't all I'd imbibed. On uppers, on downers, peyote and grass, nutmeg and mushrooms all before Sunday Mass. To the top of my head, to the toes in my shoes, dash it all, I shouldn't have added the booze. The man by the deer was at last coming too, and I hadn't the foggiest idea what to do. Back on his footing, he pointed a finger, an ivory sausage sprinkled with ginger. I ran for my house, away from the beast, that pranced like a hippo covered in grease. As I drew close the door, he fell in the mud, rousing the children with his mighty thud. They stared at me wide-eyed through wrought iron posts, looking like rosy-cheeked Aryan ghosts. I couldn't deny their looks of surprise, with the fire reflected in their glistening eyes. The flames, how they crackled! The stockings, how charred! It was a good thing no kids were around to be scarred. Oh, wait, there were kids, and behaving so rotten. They reminded me of something I'd till then forgotten. I'd been having such a wonderful holiday ball, I only then realized I had no children at all. Stuck between fire and another man's kin, I wondered whose goddamn house I was in. So chubby and plump was the man at the door. I laughed when he once again fell to the floor. But I didn't laugh after he smashed in the glass and unlocked the door surprisingly fast. He spoke not a word but went straight for my head, followed by a man dressed only in red. Santa? I squeaked before I was choked out and woke to a fireman laying me on the couch. You partied too hard, he said with a grin that had hints of eggnog, tobacco, and gin. It's the night before Christmas. This is real living, I said, and he chortled. It's only Thanksgiving.
And that was best-selling author Jessica McHugh with 'Twas the Night Before Something. You can find Jessica online at jessicamchughbooks.com. You can find her on Twitter and on Facebook as well. Her latest work is Virtuoso at Masturbation. And as I'm not lying. And it's absolutely hilarious. And it actually has some really great writer prompts in that one as well. But you would do very well to pick that one up. Her other novels include The Fantastic Pins and my personal favorite of hers, Rabbits in the Garden. Great, great body of work from Jessica McHugh. She has tons and tons and tons of novels. Check her out. She's awesome. Moving right along, we'll do another Christmas one here. This was the first appearance of this author on The Wicked Library, and it is the great, great Stephanie Witowicz. And Stephanie had the honor of being the second episode for season two, and it was pretty much an all-poetry episode. And it was a lot of fun to do, and you guys really liked that one. If you haven't heard it, I'm hoping she will be back for season three. She has a new workout. It is a collection, and it is called Hysteria, a Collection of Madness. You can find that on Amazon.com. Let's listen to two poems, winter-themed, by Stephanie Witowicz.
Winter by Stephanie Witowicz. Ice is what I know. A coldness that wraps around me, hugging me from morning till night in an embrace that cuts as well as suffocates. Frost is what I breathe, what I digest when I open my mouth to swallow snowflakes and choke on hail. Sleet is what I cry, what I weep when I see them, the air breathers that can't feel, that aren't penetrated by the souls that float next to them, waiting to crawl inside their throats the moment they yawn. Winter is what I am, a corpse left to freeze in the tundra of sin, damned to feed another's heat while I serve my sentence in rhyme. Snowman by Stephanie Watovich. She stood and watched as white puffs of dandruff fell from the sky and lay down against his ice-laden lips. His skin had crystallized into patches of frost, a velvety white on white that glistened against a pale gray sky, begging to be freed from its frozen fortress. She licked his lips, chapped and raw from the wind, and jammed sticks into his side, his scream in unison with the blood that dripped from his waist. She inserted two coal eyes on top of his own and poured another bucket of water over his already iced flesh. He was her trophy, and one day his kids would write songs about his death, desperately trying to bring him back to life.
And that was the lovely Stephanie Watovich and Winter and Snowman. You can find her online at joinmeinthemadhouse.blogspot.com. You can also find her on Facebook and, of course, on Amazon. Get her collection, Hysteria. Really, really, really solid, great stuff. Now we will move on to a Halloween story. And this was the first story on the Halloween episode. And realistically, I should have made this the last story. I read The Raven last because, you know, that one has the biggest punch, I think, historically speaking. But this author was an author I'd never heard of before doing the show. And his name was Lafcadio Hearn, and he wrote the story that you're about to hear before the turn of the 20th century. It is an old story and probably one of the more disturbing stories. I mean, he's Greek and Irish. He grew up in Dublin, moved to the States, and then spent an incredibly long time in New Orleans, and then moved to Japan, and completely fell in love with the Japanese culture, and especially the Japanese stories about ghosts. And the thing I've noticed about Japanese ghosts is they're very vengeful. And as a horror writer, I like vengeful ghosts, and Lafcadio did as well. This story is called Of a Promise Broken, and it features the debut of my daughter, Samantha, who's playing the monk bell that you hear in the background in certain sections of the story. And I wanted to play this song again just because of what a really solid, spooky ghost story this really is. And I tend to look at it as kind of like the progenitor for cinema like Ju-on and Ringu and the onslaught of Asian horror cinema. So sit back, relax, and listen to Lafcadio Hearn.
Of a Promise Broken by Lafcadio Hearn. I am not afraid to die, said the dying wife. There is only one thing that troubles me now. I wish that I could know who will take my place in this house. My dear one, answered the sorrowing husband, nobody shall ever take your place in my home. I will never, never marry again. At the time that he said this, he was speaking out of his heart, for he loved the woman whom he was about to lose. On the faith of the samurai? She questioned with a feeble smile. On the faith of a samurai, he responded, stroking the pale, thin face. Then, my dear one, she said, you will let me be buried in the garden, will you not? Near those plum trees that we planted at the further end. I wanted long ago to ask this, but I thought that if you were to marry again, you would not like to have my grave so near you.
Now you have promised that no other woman shall take my place, so I need not hesitate to speak of my wish. I want so much to be buried in the garden. I think that in the garden I should sometimes hear your voice, and that I should still be able to see the flowers in the spring. It shall be as you wish, he answered. But do not speak now of burial. You are not so ill that we have lost all hope. I have, she returned. I shall die this morning. But you will bury me in the garden? Yes, he said, under the shade of the plum trees that we planted, and you shall have a beautiful tomb there. And will you give me a little bell?
Bell?
Yes. I want you to put a little bell in the coffin. Such a little bell as the Buddhist pilgrims carry. Shall I have it?
You shall have the little bell, and anything else that you wish.
I do not wish for anything else, she said. My dear one, you have been very good to me always. Now I can die happy.
Then she closed her eyes and died, as easily as a tired child falls asleep. She looked beautiful when she was dead, and there was a smile upon her face. She was buried in the garden, under the shade of the trees that she loved, and a small bell was buried with her. Above the grave was erected a handsome monument, decorated with the family crest and bearing the Kaimao, great elder sister, luminous shadow of the plum flower chamber, dwelling in the mansion of the great sea of compassion. But within a 12-month after the death of his wife, the relatives and friends of the samurai began to insist that he should marry again. You are still a young man, they said, and an only son, and you have no children. It is the duty of a samurai to marry. If you die childless, who will be there to make the offerings and to remember the ancestors? But many such representations, he was at last persuaded to marry again. The bride was only 17 years old, and he found that he could love her dearly, notwithstanding the dumb reproach of the tomb in the garden. Nothing took place to disturb the happiness of the young wife until the 7th day after the wedding, when her husband was ordered to undertake certain duties, requiring his presence at the castle by night. On the first evening that he was obliged to leave her alone, she felt uneasy in a way that she could not explain, vaguely afraid without knowing why. When she went to bed, she could not sleep. There was a strange oppression in the air, an indefinable heaviness, like that which sometimes precedes the coming of a storm. About the hour of the ox, she heard outside in the night the clanging of a bell, a Buddhist's pilgrim's bell, and she wondered what pilgrim could be passing through the samurai quarter at such a time. Presently, after a pause, the bell sounded much nearer. Evidently, the pilgrim was approaching the house. But why approaching from the rear, where no road was? Suddenly, the dogs began to whine and howl in an unusual and horrible way, and a fear came upon her like the fear of dreams. That ringing was certainly in the garden. She tried to get up to waken a servant, but found she could not rise, could not move, could not call. And nearer, and more still near, came the clang of the bell. And oh, how the dogs howled! Then,
lightly as a shadow steals, there glided into the room a woman. Though every door stood fast and every screen unmoved, a woman robed in a grave robe and carrying a pilgrim's bell. Eyeless she came, because she had long been dead, and her loosened hair streamed down about her face, and she looked without eyes through the tangle of it, and spoke without a tongue.
Not in this house, not in this house shall you stay. Here I am mistress still. You shall go, and you shall tell none the reason of your going. If you tell him, I will tear you into pieces.
So speaking, the haunter vanished. The bride became senseless with fear. Until the dawn, she so remained. Nevertheless, in the cheery light of day, she doubted the reality of what she had seen and heard. The memory of the warning still weighed upon her so heavily that she did not dare to speak of the vision, either to her husband or to anyone else. She was almost able to persuade herself that she had only dreamed an ugly dream, which had made her ill. On the following night, however, she could not doubt. Again, at the hour of the ox, the dogs began to howl and whine. Again the bell resounded, approaching slowly from the garden. Again the listener vainly strove to rise and call. Again the dead came into the room and hissed.
You shall go, and you shall tell no one why you must go. If you even whisper it to him, I will tear you in pieces.
This time, the haunter came close to the couch and bent and muttered and mowed above it. The next morning, when the samurai returned from the castle, his young wife prostrated herself before him in supplication.
"I beseech you," she said, "to pardon my ingratitude and my great rudeness in thus addressing you, but I want to go home. I want to go away at once."
"Are you not happy here?" he asked in sincere surprise. "Has anyone dared to be unkind to you during my absence?"
"It's not that," she answered, sobbing. "Everyone here has been only too good to me, but I cannot continue to be your wife. I must go away."
"My dear," he exclaimed in astonishment, "it is very painful to know that you have had any cause for unhappiness in this house, but I cannot even imagine why you should want to go away, unless somebody has been very unkind to you. Surely you do not mean that you wish for a divorce?" She responded, trembling and weeping.
"If you do not give me a divorce, I shall die."
He remained for a little while silent, vainly trying to think of some cause for this amazing declaration. Then, without betraying any emotion, he made answer. "To send you back now to your people without any fault on your part would seem a shameful act. If you will tell me a good reason for your wish, any reason that will enable me to explain matters honorably, I can write you a divorce. But unless you give me a reason, a good reason, I will not divorce you. For the honor of our house must be kept above reproach." And then she felt obliged to speak, and she told him everything, adding in an agony of terror,
"Now that I have let you know, she will kill me. She will kill me."
Although a brave man, and little inclined to believe in phantoms, the samurai was more than startled for the moment. But the simple and natural explanation of matters soon presented itself to his mind. "My dear,"
he said. You are now very nervous, and I fear that someone has been telling you foolish stories. I cannot give you a divorce merely because you have had a bad dream in this house. But I am very sorry indeed that you should have been suffering in such a way during my absence. Tonight also I must be at the castle, but you shall not be alone. I will order two of the retainers to keep watch in your room, and you will be able to sleep in peace. They are good men, and they will take all possible care of you. Then he spoke to her so considerately and so affectionately that she became almost ashamed of her terrors, and resolved to remain in the house. The two retainers left in charge of the young wife were big, brave, simple-hearted men, experienced guardians of women and children. They told the bride pleasant stories to keep her cheerful. She talked with them a long time, laughed at their good-humored fun, and almost forgot her fears. When at last she lay down to sleep, the men-at-arms took their place in a corner of the room, behind a screen, and began a game of go-to, speaking only in whispers, that she might not be disturbed. She slept like an infant. But again, at the hour of the ox, she awoke with a moan of terror, for she heard the bell. It was already near, and was coming nearer. She started up, she screamed, but in the room there was no stir, only a silence as of death, a silence growing, a silence thickening. She rushed to the men-at-arms. They sat before their checker table, motionless, each staring at the other with fixed eyes. She shrieked to them. She shook them. They remained as if frozen. Afterwards, they said that they had heard the bell, heard also the cry of the bride, even felt her try to shake them into wakefulness, and that nevertheless, they had not been able to move or speak. From the same moment they had ceased to hear or see, a black sleep had seized upon them. Entering his bridal chamber at dawn, the samurai beheld by the light of a dying lamp the headless body of his young wife, lying in a pool of blood. Still squatting before their unfinished game, the two retainers slept. At their master's cry, they sprang up and stupidly stared at the horror on the floor. The head was nowhere to be seen, and the hideous wound showed that it had not been cut off, but torn off. A trail of blood led from the chamber to an angle of the outer gallery, where the storm doors appeared to have been riven apart. The three men followed that trail into the garden, over reaches of grass, over spaces of sand, along the bank of an iris-bordered pond, under heavy shadowings of cedar and bamboo, and suddenly, at a turn, they found themselves face to face with a nightmare thing that chippered like a bat. The figure of the long-buried woman, erect before her tomb, in one hand clutching a bell, in the other the dripping head. For a moment, the three stood, numbed. Then one of the men-at-arms, uttering a Buddhist invocation, drew and struck at the shape. Instantly it crumbled upon the soil. An empty scattering of grave rags, bones, and hair, and the bell rolled, clanking out of the room. But the fleshless right hand, though parted from the wrist, still writhed, and its fingers still gripped at the bleeding head, and tore and mangled, as the claws of the yellow crab cling fast to a fallen fruit.
wicked story. I said to the friend who had related it, "The vengeance of the dead, if taken at all, should have been taken upon the man." "Men think so," he made answer. "But that is not the way a woman feels." He was right.
And that was Lafcadio Hearn, which was the first story played on the Halloween episode during season one. And just a great story. You know, I have to make a concerted effort to go look for some more Lafcadio Hearn stuff, because I know he's got a bunch of stuff out there. And if it's anything like that story, I kind of want more. You know what I mean? So, here we are. We're at the bottom of the last best of for this the Summer of Savagery, or the Season of Savagery. And I'm doing a rare thing, which is playing one of my stories. And this was from the Chris Massacre episode, and it is a Christmas-themed story called Decorations. And it originally appeared in the Big Book of Bizarro by Burning Bulb Press. Those fine folks over there at Burning Bulb. And I've always liked this story. It's not a terribly long story. It gets where it needs to go rather quickly. And I wrote this kind of as a response to the typical, you know, abused woman story. This is kind of like, I don't know, revenge porn, I guess. And it's a pretty vengeful one. I like this one. It seems to be very popular with the ladies for some reason. So sit back, relax, and let's listen to me reading me, knowing me, knowing you. This is called Decorations.
Decorations by Nelson Piles. Riley walked out of her kitchen and into the living room. There was a small tree with lights and tinsel. No ornaments. She hated them in spite of the urgings of her boyfriend to at least have a star on the top. "It'll just look better, baby." He said that every year. Of course, other things he usually said were much worse. Things that were terrible and demeaning. The worst thing he said, though, next to "you know I love you," was the bigger lie. "I won't hit you anymore." That hurt worse than the actual hitting, because she knew it wasn't true. Of course she'd get hit again. Worse than the last time. It was always the case, but she never, ever bent on the tree. It was the one thing that was hers and hers alone. Once a year, she decorated it as she saw fit. Lights and tinsel. Period. But this year would be different. She was wearing an apron and thick black rubber gloves. The floor around the Christmas tree was lined with plastic. It had been 6 years since she first met Parker. He was handsome and funny. And oh, Christ, was he charming. She had never gone to bed with someone after knowing them only a few hours, but Parker was different. There was a connection, an almost instant attraction that she'd never had before, and she knew he was it for her. 4 months in, he had hit her for the first time. Not a slap, but a punch, right in the stomach. She crumpled instantly. She was a very petite girl, and Parker was over 6'3". He had played football in college. A lie, she later discovered. And had kept his physique. Riley had spilled a glass of wine in his white canvas high-top sneakers, and he had gone through the roof. "Oh, Jesus, I'm sorry," she had said as the rich Merlot covered his left shoe. Parker's face distorted into a knot of fury and punched her as she stood up to get a rag to clean up. "Sorry," he said sarcastically. "There, does that make it better? Look at my fucking sneaker." From that moment on, she told herself it was a fluke. They had been drinking and, well, she needed to be careful. Every punch since then, she had gone down the list of excuses for him, because as much as she feared him, She loved him. She was still attracted to him, still wanted him. He was the one and only, after all. And then, when enough had been enough, she realized she didn't love him. She hated herself for staying and told him she was leaving. When she woke up in the hospital a week later and opted not to press charges, she began to formulate her plan. She had seen him cry after that one. "Oh, baby," he sobbed. "Never again. You'll see. I love you so much. I don't know why I do it." She lay in bed looking at him, and she kind of liked watching him cry. She knew it was the same old lines, the same old bullshit. She knew what she had to do, but needed to wait for a sign. And then, right after Thanksgiving, she knew. The tree went up the day after. The smell of turkey and bread hung in the air like a cloud. It was 8:30 in the morning when Parker came downstairs and saw the tree as Riley threw on the last bit of tinsel. "Another boring-ass tree, huh?" he asked. "Just try a fucking ball or a star. It'll just look better." And then he slumped off into the kitchen. And now it was Christmas Eve. They had blown off all invitations for a surprise Riley said she had for Parker. She'd been working on it all day, so he should go out for a few hours. She smiled at him, and he left without a word. She was ready. Riley turned on the tree lights and waited patiently for Parker to come home. Hopefully he'd be home before midnight, and he did not disappoint. She heard the car door slam, and she sprang to life. Darting into the kitchen, she hid behind the door that led to the basement. Most of the lights were off, and the only lights in the front of the house were the tree lights. She smiled. The door was flung open and quickly slammed behind him. "Fucking cold," muttered Parker. He was drunk. Perfect.
"I'm here, babe,"
Riley cooed and coiled herself.
"Got anything to drink?" he asked as he lumbered toward the kitchen.
He walked in and turned the light on. He had a full 3 seconds to register that everything was covered in plastic. The stove, the counters, the floor, even the little swinging tail cat clock. He was about to speak when Riley exploded from the basement door and caught Parker behind his right ear with a swing from a pipe wrench. He fell sideways and landed hard on the floor. She looked and saw no blood. He was out. She put the wrench on the plastic-covered counter and got to work. As Parker came around, he experienced several things at once. The first thing he noticed was that his head hurt very badly, of course. The next was that Holly Jolly Christmas was skipping on the CD player that ran through the several speakers in the house. It was stuck on the "Somebody Waits for You, Kiss Her Once for Me" line of the song, except it was only saying "Somebody Waits for You, Kiss" over and over. Then the pain from his hands came next, and oh Christ, his legs. He was still on his back from the fall. He'd have to think about quitting drinking, he thought, as he tried to stand. He couldn't move. He opened his eyes and looked around. He was still on the floor of the kitchen, and the lights were really bright.
"Babe," he croaked. "Baby, I fell. I don't feel..."
He turned his head and started to vomit. He opened his eyes again and blinked after he finished, and saw the cabinet under the sink. It had red lines running down both doors.
"What's that?"
Riley called from the other room. She padded brightly to the doorway into the kitchen. He moved his head up and saw her there in her apron and gloves. She was holding something wet.
I think I fell, and I just yacked," he said.
"You did yak, and you didn't fall.
Just relax a minute, okay? And she went back to whatever it was she was doing. Parker started getting angry despite the pain. He was going to yell, but he was sweating. He reached up to rub his forehead and saw that there was a thick rubber tube like they have in hospitals tied around his elbow. The rest of his arm was missing. His eyes went wide. He lifted his other arm and saw a similar scene. "What the..." he started to say and threw up again. He spat and tried to sit up using his legs. He looked down and saw that the same thing had happened to his legs. When he came to, he saw he was in the living room. That made him feel better for about 3, maybe 4 seconds. Then he heard the CD was still skipping in the same spot. "Merry Christmas, Parker," he heard Riley say pleasantly. "I'm almost done with the tree. Do you like it?" Parker couldn't speak. He turned his head and saw it for the first time. She had put ornaments on the tree. There were 8 of his fingers with hooks through them, hanging off of the branches. His 2 hands retained the thumbs and were straining the branches they were on. His hands reminded him of the fawns for some reason. 10 toes were also sporting their places on the tree, although the pinky toes were hard to see. He began to sob. His arms and legs had been cut into chops and hung with wire instead of hooks. The branches were bent nearly down, but the chunks of flesh were cut thin, so the branches held. His feet were nowhere to be seen. Parker tried to scream but couldn't. He couldn't do anything but look at the tree and cry. He turned his head and saw Riley. She was smiling and holding an axe. "You always said it would look better, and you were right," she said. She moved next to him and sized up the axe to his neck. He looked straight up. "Too bad you won't get to see the tree topper," she said, genuinely sounding sad by the prospect. "Merry Christmas, dear." She swung as hard as she could, and the axe found its mark. The last thing Parker registered and heard before it all went silent was the CD finally catching and finishing the line.
Break it down! Oh, that's right.
It's the best time of the year.
Watch me play now.
I think the funnest part of that was doing the Holly Jolly Christmas song in the background. That was way fun. And doing my very best Frank Zappa voice to sing the parts and then playing with the pitch. Anyway, that was me reading me. kind of weird. And I tend not to do it a lot. I mean, in 50 or 60 plus episodes of doing this show, I've read my work twice. And haven't replayed it too terribly often, but that may change with season 3, as I do have something to promote, which is my new novel, Demons, Dolls, and Milkshakes, which you can get right now on Amazon.com, also at postmortem-press.com. And a little quick plug for me, I will be at the Horror Realm in Pittsburgh the weekend of the 20th, September 20th, through the 22nd at the Postmortem Press table. Me and Eric Beebe will be hanging out. I think Chris Brown may be swinging by. You never know who's going to come by, but we will have nice, big, fresh, lovely copies of my first novel. And please check it out and let me know what you think. I want to thank all of you for sticking with us. This has been 11 weeks of best of episodes. Wow, you guys are patient. And it's all going to pay off. About midweek before the season premiere, I will be putting up a special rebroadcast of the season finale. And there is a reason for this. As you may or may not remember, you probably do remember, the season finale was none other than our very own Maddie Holliday Von Stark. And it was the first chapter of her novel, The Widow's Game. Well, I got lots of mail about what a dick I was for leaving all of you hanging by reading simply one chapter. So, talked it over with Von Stark, and the season premiere will be Chapter 2 of The Widow's Game by Maddie Von Stark. See? I helped you. You only had to wait 11 weeks for it, right? That will be September 20th. And on behalf, this was a lot of fun. I want to really, honestly, thank you all for sticking with the show. The show's growing. It's getting bigger. There's more people checking us out. We've got a lot of cool stuff cooking. Von Stark and I do. Yes, we do. Yes, we do. And I want to thank Maddie. She's really made this show a lot more fun since she came along. Just brilliant artwork, brilliant writing, and best partner ever. Thanks, Maddie. And on behalf of Maddie Von Stark and Jessica McHugh, Stephanie Witovich, and Mandy DeGate, and hopefully Lafka D'O'Hearn, until next time, maybe keep the lights on. This is Nelson W. Piles. See you next week for the big premiere.